This week on the Allegheny Front, we're talking about pipelines, the infrastructure that moves natural gas from the well to the places where it's used. We'll talk to people who want to build more pipelines quickly, and those that say, not so fast.
You can't stop the vigilance, you know. People got to keep standing in their way.
I'm Carol Holsapple. Also, one group says the science is in on the link between toxic chemicals and the risks for developing autism. And we spend some time with foresters who are sizing up saplings and more in Pittsburgh.
I know what I like in a tree.
Those environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. There is a building boom for pipelines in the Northeast right now. But many are uneasy about allowing these new pipelines so close to where they live. Months after an interstate gas pipeline ruptured east of Pittsburgh, the question of safety is on the minds of many in the region. As part of our summer series, Follow the Pipeline, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the federal government is trying to ratchet up safety rules. But there are limits on what these new rules can do.
On the morning of April 29th, news helicopters circled a charred field in Salem Township, Westmoreland County, where just hours before, a pipeline had exploded. It was the Texas Eastern Transmission Pipeline. When he got there, the heat from the flames was so hot, local fire chief Bob Rosati had to stay in his truck.
Now, that was the biggest fireball I've ever seen in my life. Thank God it was in a rural area where we're at, and it didn't pose that much of a problem. It could have been a lot worse if we were in a more populous area.
There was one person injured. 26-year-old James Baker was in his house a few hundred feet away from the blast. He was badly burned and his house destroyed. Investigators think external corrosion on the pipe caused the blast, but they're still investigating. The explosion comes as the federal government is trying to make transmission pipelines like the Texas Eastern safer, and also while the country is building more pipelines. The Department of Energy predicts Pennsylvania and Ohio will nearly double their natural gas production by the year 2030. So companies in the region are building more natural gas transmission lines, which carry gas at high pressure across long distances. Many in the path of these new pipelines are asking if they should be worried about accidents like what happened in Salem Township. At a public meeting a few weeks after the explosion, officials from Spectra Energy, which owns the Texas Eastern, addressed a roomful of sometimes angry residents. Here's company representative Devin Hotzel.
We're here sincerely. We want to answer these questions. We know there's questions. We may not have all the answers tonight because this is an ongoing process.
Many in attendance were used to living near pipelines and other gas infrastructure. Lisa Seguina leases out her land for around $20 a year to a company that stores gas under her property.
They need to do this safer. They need to find a safe way to move gas. I understand we need it. We need energy. I understand we need to frack. I get that. But there's safe ways to do it.
Seguina said what upset her the most was the fact that it took almost an hour for the company to shut off the gas in the pipeline after the explosion.
It was because they had to drive 15 miles to get to a valve to shut this off. So they said they first recognized that there was an issue, and then someone had to drive 15 miles to shut this valve off.
Spectra officials declined to be interviewed for this story, but in an email, a spokesman says the industry standard is to shut off pipelines within an hour of any incident. They also stressed that this pipeline met all federal inspection rules, including an inside-the-pipe inspection in 2012. Pipeline companies like to point out they are statistically safer than alternatives, like railroads or trucks. And the overall trend is that they've gotten safer over the past few decades. And yet, over the past 10 years, more than 300 serious pipeline incidents have resulted in 132 deaths, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. And these accidents can often take place close to where people live. In fact, Rebecca Craven of the Watchdog Pipeline Safety Trust says there's no minimal setback for pipelines from homes and buildings established by the federal government.
There are situations where new pipelines are going through, and even with the ability to move away from a house or a group of houses, they are choosing to run a straight line and go close to those houses simply because it's cheaper or because there's a wetland that they'd have to get a wetland permit to go through.
Just down the road from where the Salem Township explosion happened, Rob Brown could be living very close to one of these pipelines soon. Dominion Transmission wants to put a large natural gas pipeline just down the hill from his back door.
It's about, I think, 200 feet.
When Brown first heard about the pipeline, he thought about moving, but then decided against it. The company says its pipelines are safe. But Brown says news of the explosion jolted him and raised the alert of people in this suburban neighborhood.
Something like that happens to a neighbor, the word spreads. It's not safe. There's definitely a risk.
The federal agency in charge of pipeline safety recently proposed new rules that may protect areas like Brown's neighborhood. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, came out with the rules in response to a major explosion in San Bruno, California in 2010 that killed 8 people. As the rules are currently written, pipelines in densely populated areas undergo the most stringent safety inspections. But the feds are proposing to add protections for suburban and less populated areas too, and add more pressure testing for older lines. A separate rule could mandate more use of automatic shutoff valves, which would have stopped the Salem Township fire sooner.
You know, it's a very deliberate, incremental process.
Stacy Girard is former chief of pipeline safety at PHMSA and now works as a consultant. She says any new rule must pass a cost-benefit analysis. If the overall costs of imposing a rule outweigh the benefits from, say, avoiding property damage, injuries, even death, the government can't pass it. Girard says that makes imposing safety regulations tough.
You know, there's things that actions, improvements that the agency would like to make that if they can't come out with a positive analysis, it won't make it into the rule. So there's no, you know, waving a magic wand and saying, okay, we're going to get this, all the improvements that we would like in this new rule. It's just not possible.
PHMSA did not respond to interview requests for this story. Girard says most pipelines were built in places that once were rural and now are more developed. According to Girard, more than 12,000 schools in the U.S. are now within 1,000 feet of a major natural gas transmission line. Given that proximity, she said, there will always be tension between sending gas around the country and keeping people near them safe. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Remember this classic scene in the movie The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
That movie came out nearly 50 years ago, but today some might also see a future in plastics. Just look at the 600 permanent jobs Shell says it'll create with an ethane cracker it plans to build in Beaver County, near the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. It'll make ethane into plastics, and more of these plants are in the works for this region. That's because fuels like ethane, propane, and butane are abundant here. They're the byproducts of natural gas that's being fracked, and they're part of the push to build new pipelines. But the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that some landowners are fighting back by saying products like ethane used to make plastic only benefit private companies.
The quiet hills of eastern Ohio and Harrison County have become a popular spot, and not just for the cicadas you hear, but also for oil and gas development. Mick Luber grows his tomatoes, greens, even fava beans here at his organic farm and sells them at markets in Pittsburgh and Wheeling. He says recent years have brought a compressor station and multiple well sites so close, they wake him up at night.
For the first year that they were fracking, it was hard for me to go outside. I felt so bad hearing the roar of all this stuff. It's nice to have the cicadas that drowned them out.
Now pipeline companies like Kinder Morgan are showing up. They came knocking on Luber's door.
They wanted to come right down through this main field and go up over top of that hill. There's a spring right up there. That's the most fertile part of this farm.
Marathon is already building a pipeline on the southern border of his farm. Luber points up to the valley where pipes are lined up waiting to be connected. The ground has been stripped bare.
this is what you end up with. This was all woods.
Shell is also planning a line here. So when Kinder Morgan showed up, Luber said no. No pipeline, not even a survey.
I told him I didn't want it.
Kinder Morgan sued. One of the main arguments in Luber's defense, the contents of Kinder Morgan's pipeline. Not natural gas for home heating, but to send ethane to Canada for Nova Chemicals to make plastics. Ethane, along with propane and butane, are known as natural gas liquids. They're byproducts of natural gas that's been fracked in the region. Increasingly, landowners are arguing that they shouldn't have to give up their property rights for companies to transport these liquids to make plastics, especially if they're being sent to foreign countries. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Foer says, yes, they should. Plastics are in the public interest.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives, from cups to medical devices to automobiles.
You might think the federal government would have a say in whether transporting these natural gas liquids to make plastics is important enough to usurp individual property rights. If this were a natural gas pipeline, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, would have authority over siting its route. But what about these liquids like ethane?
FERC has no authority to regulate natural gas liquids in the United States at all.
Attorney Rich Raiders represents about a dozen landowners in Pennsylvania against eminent domain action from a different pipeline company, Sunoco Logistics. He says when FERC has authority, as it does for siting natural gas pipelines, landowners have a say in how it's routed.
That's an all-public, eyes-open discussion, whereas for natural gas liquid line, that's between the individual landowner and the pipeline operator, and no government entity is involved at all.
Well, the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration does require permits for large earth disturbances and around bodies of water for pipeline routes. But when it comes to eminent domain, that's being decided in state courts. The Kentucky Supreme Court recently let a lower court ruling stand. It found that the pipeline company in that case is not a public utility, which means it does not have the power of eminent domain to site a natural gas liquids pipeline. In Pennsylvania, pipeline companies that want eminent domain power also have to get certified as a public utility by the State Public Utility Commission, the PUC. To do that, they have to show that their project will benefit the people of the Commonwealth. And what that means is under debate. One of the biggest headline grabbers on this issue has been Sunoco's Mariner East project. It includes two pipelines, an older one that's been repurposed and a newer one, both carrying natural gas liquids. The new line begins in Ohio, near Mick Luber's farm in Harrison County, runs through Pennsylvania to the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex on the Delaware border near Philadelphia. From there, Rader says the propane is being shipped to Europe.
That's not a need of the Commonwealth.
And so he argues Sunoco should not have the power of eminent domain. The company would not record an interview for this story. In an email to the Allegheny Front, Sunoco says the project will provide propane for heating fuel to markets in Pennsylvania. Sunoco says for the Mariner East 2 pipeline, it's a utility based on a certification granted by the PUC to their older pipeline back in the 1930s. Some are fighting that stance in court, and a state appeals court recently sided with Sunoco. Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court ruled in July that the company is a public utility and that that power extends to all 17 counties along the pipeline's path. Sunoco's email says still they've come to agreement with the majority of landowners. Attorney Nicholas Anderson represents a landowner in Harrison County that's in Ohio. The Teeter family is fighting Sunoco's eminent domain action.
The bottom line is that when they're approaching landowners in Ohio, they have this big stick called eminent domain. And so they say, look, we'll give you X number of dollars per linear foot, but if you don't accept that, we're just going to take your property. And that is where we have a problem.
Anderson says along that Kinder Morgan ethane pipeline from Ohio to Canada, the one farmer Mick Luber was fighting, the company recently filed 130 eminent domain cases in at least 8 Ohio counties. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Foer says they only take eminent domain action as a last resort.
If you look at our route, you can see a lot of zigs and zags and turns, certainly not a straight line. Those are all based upon big issues like avoiding environmentally sensitive areas or individual landowner concerns.
Like Mick Luber. Kinder Morgan recently announced they would reroute around his farm. Still, Luber doesn't see it as a victory.
Well, as long as these guys are still doing this stuff, what is the victory, you know? You can't stop the vigilance, you know? People got to keep standing in their way.
Kinder Morgan says Luber got what he wanted, but the company wants to make it clear they can't reroute for every landowner who has a problem with their pipeline. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Next week, we follow the pipeline to New York's Finger Lakes, where the energy industry is going head-to-head with another industry, wineries. We'll look at the debate over storing natural gas in salt caverns near a lake that provides drinking water to 100,000 people. It's also home to some of the top vintners in the world. That's next week on the Allegheny Front. When your job is to count trees out in the forest, there can be hazards. Sunburn, even a bear circling you. But when your forestry job moves into the city, you're still not safe.
This tree's got a bunch of poison ivy on it. I'm fairly allergic to poison ivy.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we're taking a closer look at urban trees. Stay tuned, and stay away from those plants with three leaves. According to the Centers for Disease Control, one in six American children has a learning or developmental disability. Over the last year and a half, a group called Project Tender looked at hundreds of peer-reviewed studies on these types of disorders and environmental factors. And they say the evidence is at a tipping point. Toxic chemicals are increasing the risk of American children for neurodevelopmental disorders. Their finding was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. Tender co-director Maureen Swanson says it's the first time a group of scientists and medical professionals has come together for such a consensus statement. I spoke with Swanson about it here at our studio. As the statement says, the kinds of disorders you're talking about, autism, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, intellectual disabilities, are complex. They have multiple causes, including genetics. So how do chemicals and environmental toxins factor into the risks for children developing these disorders?
These disorders are very complex. There are multiple factors coming into play, nutrition, social stressors, but children, and especially during prenatal development, the brain develops very rapidly. Even a low-level exposure to certain chemicals can disrupt those processes. And then children's metabolism is such that they're taking in more air, more water, more food per pound of their body weight than adults do. So an exposure that wouldn't hurt an adult can be very detrimental to a child. And finally, young children put their hands in their mouths, put toys in their mouths. They spend a lot of time on the floor, crawling around. And so a number of these chemicals and pollutants settle into household dust and are found in food.
So we're talking about chemicals that are found in a number of different places, in the environment, in consumer products.
Yes. The scientists and health professionals in Tender identified five chemicals that are really great examples of the types of chemicals that are putting children at risk. Certain pesticides, organophosphate pesticides that are heavily used in agriculture, air pollutants, and people think of air pollution and asthma or heart disease, but now the body of scientific evidence shows that air pollution is detrimental to brain development and is contributing to these disorders. Certain flame retardants that are found in furniture and electronics, lead, of course, which everybody is familiar with, and then a group of chemicals that was named as an emerging concern among many emerging concerns are called phthalates, and those are chemicals that are used in food packaging, used in personal care products as fragrances. So these chemicals are, in some ways, they're everywhere. They're in our homes and schools and products. They're also chemicals that we know can be replaced with safer alternatives, that we know can be reduced, that we can eliminate them, essentially.
Now, Congress just overhauled TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which hadn't been updated in 30 years, and it gives the Environmental Protection Agency the power to regulate new or existing chemicals. So are the efforts to protect the public, in this case children especially, from potential neurotoxins failing, and what's the alternative?
Our regulatory system in many ways is fundamentally broken, so that the vast majority of chemicals are not proven safe before they're put into products and emitted into the air and water. The reform of the Toxic Substances Control Act, the new TSCA statute, will give EPA new authorities to test chemicals. It's a step in the right direction, but it remains to be seen whether Congress will fully fund the EPA to do all this work. There are thousands and thousands of chemicals that need to be tested now. There's a huge backlog. And also whether EPA will aggressively implement the new law. And finally, TSCA reform, it's not sufficient for the magnitude of the problem. So some of these chemicals that are contributing to problems with brain development and neurodevelopmental disorders are not covered under TSCA. They're covered under different laws. A good example is pesticides. Certain uses of some chemicals are under the authority of the Food and Drug Administration rather than the Environmental Protection Agency.
So what would be an alternative, or what are you proposing?
Across the board, what the tender experts are calling for is that for these chemicals where we already know, these pesticides and flame retardants, those chemicals should be eliminated from use. We don't need any further study. We know they're bad. The tender experts are developing specific recommendations on revising how scientific evidence is assessed and how chemicals are tested and evaluated so that we do a much better job of identifying chemicals that put children at risk.
The chemicals that you're talking about, you know, flame retardants and combustion-related air pollutants, are pervasive. I mean, these are substances that children and pregnant women that we're all exposed to every day from a number of different sources. And so, you know, you're calling on businesses to eliminate them and policymakers to better regulate them and get rid of some of them. And that seems like a massive undertaking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are your expectations that there will be some changes or movement made in the direction that you're pushing for?
That is a massive undertaking. And to some degree, we've dug a very deep hole for ourselves. But there are some positive steps in the right direction. The new TSCA law is one of those steps. Some of the worst organophosphate pesticides were banned from residential use, but they still are used in agriculture. So we would like EPA, in this instance, to go ahead and ban those pesticides from use in agriculture. And then the next step, of course, is to ensure that the replacement pesticides or the replacement flame retardants have been tested and are shown to be safe or safer before they're used. And there are a lot of businesses and universities where there's great innovation happening in green chemistry, but there need to be incentives to use safer chemicals and to develop safer chemicals so that our products are safe, especially for pregnant women and children.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Maureen Swanson is with the Learning Disabilities Association. That's a national advocacy group headquartered here in Pittsburgh. She's also co-director of Project Tender. The group just had a congressional briefing about their findings. We'll link you to their consensus statement at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. So we know the federal government does a population census every decade, but did you know it also counts trees? The U.S. Forest Service inventories the types and condition of trees in sample plots spread out across the country, and they've been doing it since the 1930s. For most of that time, when that random sample plot fell within an urban area, which wasn't technically a forest, they didn't count it. But 80% of us live in or near cities. So in 2014, they started to record what was happening with urban trees. And now Pittsburgh is one of a growing number of cities on their radar. I met up with some foresters near an elementary school just north of Pittsburgh as they were collecting the data this summer. Mike Whitehill meets me in the parking lot behind the school, then holds my hand as we traverse down a steep slope where wooden steps have been swallowed by a grassy hillside.
So be careful going down here.
As we wade through waist-high wildflowers, our shirts are constantly getting stuck on thorny branches.
This is multiflora rose, very bad invasive, something that will tally on this plot.
He says it can crowd out native plants and trees. We made it.
Okay.
We have company.
At the bottom, I meet White Hills colleague, Mitch Pennebaker. He says first we're inspecting what's happening under the tree canopy, low to the ground.
We're looking at seedlings and saplings. A sapling is anything greater than an inch in diameter, but less than 5 inches, which is the cutoff for a tree.
Okay, we do have an ash. Which, have you heard anything about the emerald ash borer?
It's another invasive pest. This one is a beetle that's wiped out millions of ash trees.
I've been measuring dead and dying ash in Pennsylvania for the last 3 years. I don't know that we know what's going to happen with the seedlings. If the borer is going to be around to kill them when they get big enough, so we don't really know. But it is nice to see we still have some seedlings.
I think this is a hawthorn, Mitch. Then we got another ash, two more ash.
As he shouts them out, Pennebaker enters the species into a data recorder hanging around his neck. It looks like the kind of machine you sign when a package is delivered.
And then we also code building data. You know, trees obviously provide shade to buildings, which lower cooling costs. So now the fun begins, Mike.
Yes, it does.
It's time to count the big trees.
This is our plot center. So from this dowel, any trees within 48 feet, we're going to measure. So it looks like to me we're going to have maybe 10 to 15, which isn't a lot.
He says that hasn't been the case in other urban plots here.
It seems like the city of Pittsburgh has a lot of areas that are too steep that didn't get developed. So with a random sample of these plots, a lot of them fall in there. So it's a challenge.
Okay, I'm going in, Mitch. Okay, that's the distance.
Right, that'll be 35.7.
Okay, and then this tree's got a bunch of poison ivy on it. Not sure how I'm gonna approach this. I gotta get some of that ivy off of it. I'm fairly allergic to poison ivy, so we can't estimate them.
It's a black cherry tree.
762 for our purposes. We code all in numbers.
Whitehall nimbly climbs back up the bank to get a wider view and peers through the scope of a laser. He points it at the cherry tree to determine its height.
It has a little red bead. You just gotta get it on any part of the bole. The bole is, you know, below the foliage, down to the stump. See, it shows me it's 44 feet away. And once I got that, then you just shoot the base and then the top, and it spits out a number. 84 feet, Mitch. It's a tall one.
It has a thin crown. That's the leafy part of the tree. Whitehill's also looking for how much of the tree gets sunlight and if there are any dead branches.
When you're out like enjoying nature and you're not working, do you look at trees and assess them?
I know what I like in a tree. Open grown white oaks, you know, with a real big crown. Sometimes you see them in old fields. I like that kind of look. Yeah, I guess I assess trees on my own time. It's kind of fun.
Whitehill and Pennebaker and a handful of others will keep plodding along. It'll take 7 years to collect all of the data on Pittsburgh's 200 sample sites. Forest inventory analysis data is available online, and it's free. As always, there's more on our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. Our series Follow the Pipeline is funded by the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.